What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
We're getting very excited. We're about a week away from an amazing trip that it has been on our bucket list for over 10 years.
Yeah.
We're going to Thailand.
Sure are.
Oh, you're upset, aren't you? Kat's been doing all of the booking for the airlines, and while we're there, we're going to be flying from Bangkok to Chiang Mai, another city north of Bangkok, and a few other things, and she has been booking all of these domestic Thailand flights.
And you've been very sweet, just being really supportive, and, you know, thank you for spearheading this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know this makes you nervous, because it does, especially because I'm booking for other people. It's not just me, and it's not just you and me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, I'm hyper vigilant that I'm getting things right.
Well, also the one of the websites, one of the airlines that you were booking a flight on was in Thai.
It was Vietnamese.
Oh, it was Vietnamese. Oh, that's right. It was Vietjet.
Yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, you had to book a flight in Vietnamese.
Which is fine. I'm okay with that. And I, you know, got through the process yesterday. I was booking the leg from Chiang Mai to Phuket. And I was like, okay, here's what we're going to do. And I'm putting all of our passenger information in. And this airline specifically has an option to choose a primary passenger. And that's me, right?
Right. Well, you're booking it. Yeah.
Right. I'm the primary passenger.
It's on your credit card.
That's right. It's my contact information.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm filling everything out, put all my information, primary passenger in, and then our guest who's coming with us, and then you, and made sure that everything's the way that it should be, just paid for everything with my credit card,
right?
Because I'm the primary passenger, provided my contact information because I'm the primary passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And after I finished doing that, and I, you know, felt this incredible sense of relief because I get so jacked up about it, right? And then I got an email addressed to fucking you about the flights that you just booked.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You booked three flights.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only male.
Mm-hmm.
I was not the primary passenger.
Nope.
You were.
Yep.
You paid for it on your credit card with your name on it. And because it appears that I was the
only
mister
on the itinerary.
Yeah, so I was the primary. That's hilarious.
Is it? Is it hilarious?
Well, you know, I mean, it's only fair. Men own everything, so it's understandable that they would feel that way. You know, I'm just saying that to get a rise out of you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. No, I can't understand. I really can't. I'm a guy. I can't understand what that must be like. But it is kind of funny.
It's infuriating, is what it is.
And a little funny.
It's bullshit.
Anyway, thank you for booking that.
Mm-hmm.
And for letting me take all the credit.
All right. I'm all right now. I mean, really, the worst thing that happened to me is that I had a frustrating moment while booking a dream trip to Thailand, right? I mean, how mad can I be?
You're right. Right, exactly. And then we relaxed later that evening. What was that time travel movie, that quirky little film that we watched?
Beyond the Infinite 2 Minutes.
I've been on a real time travel movie kick.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most recent one that we watched.
So much fun.
Strange, but delightful. So I kind of had my own boo effect when I came across this story that I'm about to tell you, which involves time travel.
Interesting.
It's the story of a guy named Mike Markham. He was known as a bit of a genius. In 1995, he was 21 years old, and he was a student majoring in electrical engineering.
Okay.
As an intelligent young man, he loved to invent things. He liked to experiment with different projects, just kind of tinkering with things. It was at this time, 1995, when Mike was living in Stanbury, Missouri. and he decided to create what is known. This is just kind of a little project he was tinkering with. He wanted to create what is known as a Jacob's Ladder. Now, I know you hate that movie.
I do. It really fucked me up. And I think I was too young to watch it in the first place. And that was the case with several movies that I watched as a young person. A Night in the Life of Jimmy Reardon is another one where I was like, what are all these body parts? I've never seen these before.
These were films that your dad bought. They were like all recorded off HBO on VHS tapes. Mm-hmm. And your dad bought a lot of VHS
Flashdance
tapes.
Flashdance was the first time I saw boobs. But I also became very interested in welding. So, you know, there's a give and take.
A Jacob's Ladder is something that you've probably seen in the movies, like, you know, like a mad scientist movie. It's essentially two parallel wires connected to a transformer at the bottom.
And this like Optimus Prime or?
It's not that kind of a transformer, honey.
Sorry.
It creates a potential difference between the wires. Now, when the Jacob's Ladder is turned on, electrons are fed into one of the wires. These electrons repel each other, so they jump across to the other wire. The wire is connected, that wire is connected to the ground, and when they jump, we see a spark. Now, the spark heats up the surrounding air, and as the hot air rises, the spark rises with it. The sparks jump back and forth between the two wires and, quote, climb the ladder. You've probably seen that sort of thing in old horror movies. Very Tesla kind of thing. Anyway, it's a cool little experiment, and that's what Mike was out to do. On his porch. In his house.
Adorable.
In Missouri. He wanted to try to improve the efficiency of the device, and to do that, his idea was to reduce air resistance between the two poles by using a compact disc laser that he had modified. He was hoping that this modification would result in a continuous arc.
Okay.
But when he turned it on, something very unexpected happened. He saw what he described as a heat signature. You know, those wavy lines that you see on a hot highway on a warm summer afternoon that looks like water.
Oh, almost. Kind of like I would picture on a Nevada highway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This heat signature appeared between the two wires and was unusual because it was circular in nature. He described it as looking like a vortex. So he was intrigued by this.
Sure.
And so he picked up a sheet metal screw that was lying on the porch floor, and he tossed it through the vortex to see what would happen. He claims the screw disappeared for about a half a second. It appeared to blip out and then back into reality. He continued to throw screws, or conduct experiments, I guess would be a more professional way of putting it. He did that a few more times with the same results until the CD laser overheated and caught on fire.
Okay.
So now he's intrigued with this phenomena and starts to theorize on what was happening to the screws. And one thought he had was perhaps he had stumbled upon some sort of time-warping device. So the only way forward in his mind was to scale the experiment up and try again.
Obviously. It's like a reverse Honey, I Shrunk the Kids kind of situation.
I thought the same thing when I was putting this story together.
It is because we just watched Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
So he's going to scale this up, but to do it, he was going to need a much more powerful transformer. And so he starts looking into what it would take to purchase something like that, and he found that they were far more expensive than he could afford, way above his pay grade. So he came up with an alternative solution, and not a very good one.
All right.
He located six old transformers that were being stored at a St. Joseph Light and Power Generating Station in King City, Missouri. Nobody was using them. They were just sitting there. So he decided to liberate them, shall we say.
Sure.
He estimated that to conduct his experiment, he needed three transformers to generate the needed power. But he took all six just to make sure.
Sure.
Each one weighed over 300 pounds.
Oof.
Now, when he got his new improved Jacob's Ladder / time machine built, he knew that he wouldn't be able to just run it off residential electric power. And understandably, he was reluctant to call the power company because they'd ask all kinds of pesky questions that he didn't want to answer.
Sure.
So he decided to climb a power pole. Now, I should probably stop right here and say, don't climb power poles.
I was just going to say, is this story better suited for the shallow end?
It starts out that way, doesn't it? It's a bad idea climbing power poles. Even if you're an electrical genius like Mike was, I don't recommend it. Anyway, he hooks it up and then he switches on his much more powerful Jacob's ladder. And it sucked so much power from the grid, way more than he expected, that it caused a brownout over half of the town.
Oh no.
There were reports of appliances in homes nearby catching fire and exploding. So, it didn't take long for the police to figure out what was going on. And Gentry County Sheriff Eugene Lupfer executed a search warrant on January 29th, 1995. And inside Mike's house, they found and retrieved all six of the stolen transformers. And the estimated value was somewhere around $15,000, between $12,000 and $15,000. So when he's arrested, he's really playing up the whole time machine angle. And I think he was hoping that maybe they would think he was just a nut job and and he wouldn't have to go to jail. But they sentenced him to 60 days in jail. A newspaper in Kansas City, the Kansas City Star, did a story on this and mentioned the whole time machine angle. And that's when Art Bell from Coast to Coast AM got in touch.
Oh, moment for Art Bell.
I loved Art Bell. George Norrie is fine, but Art Bell.
There was no need to throw the George Norrie shade.
No, I didn't mean to. He's fine. So getting out of jail, Markham appeared on Coast to Coast AM, and he told his story about the screw and his theory about how perhaps this might be some sort of a time machine. He swore that he was going to scale things up, but would do it legally this time.
Fair enough.
He said he'd get started on his next experiment as soon as he could come up with some spare parts or money to make it happen. Because of his appearance on the show, many people reached out to him with ideas and funding and spare parts that he might need.
I love that.
This second Jacob's ladder, which he created, was much bigger than the previous one, which was pretty big because it blew out the power. That one ran at about a kilowatt rate. His new one was at 3 megawatts.
1.21 gigawatts.
And instead of throwing a screw through the vortex, this time he planned to test it on himself.
Oh.
So a year went by and Markham appears on Art Bell's show again, and he said that he is refining his design and using a more sophisticated approach, and that the electromagnetic vortex was now big enough for a man to walk through. He said he was very close to generating enough voltage to run the machine, and that was the last obstacle to overcome. He claimed that he was less than 30 days away from testing. One of the callers asked him, if he planned on taking anything with him when he traveled in time, and he just laughed and said, probably just his cell phone. So even back then, cell phones were an integral part of people's lives. So that was the last time anybody heard from Mike Markham.
What?
For a while.
Oh.
It appeared as though he just vanished in 1997. And there are those who say he was never seen or heard from again. Later that year, a caller to the Art Bell show said they'd come across an archived newspaper article from the 1930s.
Okay.
In it, they talked about finding a man dead on a beach in California. He appeared to have been crushed to death in a strange metal tube. With him was a mysterious handheld device near his body. The description of the device was consistent with how one would describe a cell phone from that time.
Do we have access to this article?
No.
No.
I tried to find it. You know, no.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to address those who say he was never seen or heard from again. This apparently is not true.
Okay.
It does, however, seem as though he dropped off the radar for a while, up to a couple of years. So while doing research for this story, I came across a Reddit thread that they were discussing this. And in the thread, one of the participants claimed to be Mike Markham. It said, "The real Mike Markham" was his Reddit name. In the thread, He said that the story about him being crushed in a tube in the 1930s California was definitely not him. He also claimed that a picture that had been circulating on sites purportedly of him was not him. Obviously, there were people in this thread that thought he was full of shit and that this was all a hoax.
Right.
And he said this. He said, "I wish it was a hoax." For years, he said, people have been contacting him, calling him, writing him, sending emails, and just showing up at his house to try to get him to go back in time and change something in the past that they didn't like.
Aww.
And he said, oftentimes, they would threaten him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, people are desperate, especially like if you think about people who really want to change something in time. So often it's got to do with loved ones,
yes,
or
yeah,
the loss of someone. Mm-hmm. And they get desperate. You remember that Denzel movie?
Yes. Yeah.
John Q or something like that. You get desperate.
Somebody on the thread asked him if he actually did time travel. And he said, yes, never back in time. Only forward.
Oh.
Which I guess we could all really say when you think about it. We're all traveling forward in time. But he said that when he jumped ahead, he traveled back to his house and all of his things were gone and his house was vacant. So if it was true, then the account of his disappearance for a couple of years after 1997 would kind of fit into the story.
Okay.
There were also rumors that he was homeless and insane, and that there were sightings of him in Hawaii. He said all of this was bullshit, that he is now living in Ohio, and has for a while. So, I did an internet background search using the information that I had on him, like how old he was when he was on Art Bell, so I figured out what year he was born in, the towns that he lived in that were listed in the articles, and of course his name. And I found something kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah?
You know, I'm getting pretty good at these internet background searches. Whenever we look at buying property, I can find out people's mortgages.
I know.
It's really kind of creepy.
It is creepy.
I use my power for good, though. There is a guy named Michael Markham who was born in the right year and who lived in that small Missouri town in the mid-90s.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that he is currently living in Ohio. So all of these pieces of information that I could find on this guy checks out with the story. I have found several media pages that were connected to this individual, and they've all been shut down. I was even able to find his public Amazon wish list page.
What's on it?
Yeah, I've gotten good at it. What's on it is these two items. A 13-inch heat-resistant protective furnace glove.
That seems right.
For refining and casting gold, silver, copper, or aluminum, and a 13.5-inch crucible tongs for graphite furnace use for melting and casting, refining copper, silver, and aluminum, and gold. It certainly fits the profile.
It absolutely does. That's very interesting.
The story is interesting, but probably bullshit. As much as I want to believe this, yeah, I really would, I'd love this to be true.
Of course.
But there is a guy who is out there living in Ohio right now.
Underneath a dead Ohio sky.
Who fits the profile of this story and that guy perfectly. Name, age, towns
Amazon
he's lived
wish
in,
list.
Stuff on his wish list. My source information, an article on citydata.com, Mysteries Unsolved, and wonders.physics.wisc.edu.
Amazing.
And now, that thing in the middle. In 1857, the SS Central America sank during a hurricane en route from Panama to New York City. The wreck was located in 1988, and in 1991, among other things, a trunk was found. The trunk was full of many personal items, including a pair of what appear to be very old jeans. Even though the jeans weren't marked, they show a lot of similarities to the early miner pants that Levi Strauss invented. Recently, these jeans sold at auction for $114,000.
We got this message from Brent on Instagram. I just wanted to share my daughter's Christmas cookie for her boyfriend's family cookie contest, which I think is an awesome idea, by the way. She won the contest, and he shared the photo. And this gingerbread cookie looks like maybe it's been through an autopsy. It is very pale. Uh-huh. Its midsection is entirely red and chunky.
Uh-huh.
And you can clearly see a rib cage.
Oh, my God.
So it's delightful. Thank you, Brent. Thank you.
And Michael sent us this email. Just thought I'd share an interesting fact with you. A piece of widely known common knowledge is that when performing CPR, it's helpful to sing the song Stayin' Alive by the 70s disco kings, the Bee Gees, in order to keep the correct rhythm during chest compressions. A lesser known fact, however, is that the beats per minute of Jethro's much lauded, sure to be hit, What You Got For Me, is the perfect accompaniment to a couple's intimate time. The pulsing beat combined with Jethro's dulcet tones really sets the mood and ensures a good time was had by all.
Yep. Jethro's dulcet tones. Yeah, that always works.
Sure, it's not a long song, but unfortunately for my fiancé, that isn't a problem for me. Many regards, Michael, a box fan from Sheffield, England.
Wow. That is glorious. Thank you so much, Michael.
I think, and I wrote back to Michael, I said, this is the best email I've ever received. It's right up there anyway.
We also received some actual mail. Thank you so much to Rick and Steve, who sent us a glorious package. I don't even think that I can fully express the range and beauty of the things contained within. I got a Southwest style stone inlay pocket knife, which is gorgeous and will never come on a flight with me.
Yeah, make sure that's not in your backpack when we go to the airport.
Shell-based panda-style Christmas ornaments, sweet treats, dog toys.
Rick and Steve, you guys are the best.
I can't get enough.
They are founding members, charter members of the Inner Circle of Freaks. They've been with us since the very, very beginning, and we just love them.
You're listening to The Box of Oddities. Hang on, we just got a text. Not sure we made a... Okay, that can wait. This is The Box of Oddities.
All right, your turn.
The Northeast United States, it has a wealth of fine art. It seems like just around every corner you can find the home of an O'Keefe, a Cassatt, a Homer, all the Ninja Turtles. Within this cornucopia of talent and creativity is a special place that also celebrates art, a different kind of art. It's the Museum of Bad Art.
I'm listening.
The Museum of Bad Art, or MOBA as it's known, says it's the world's only museum dedicated to the collection, preservation, exhibition, and celebration of bad art in all its forms. The Museum of Bad Art was established in 1994 when Scott Wilson recovered a painting from a Boston trash heap. The painting, Lucy in the Field with Flowers, is a portrait of a mature woman in a floral house dress, sitting precariously on a mostly unseen stool, though some have interpreted her as dancing, in a field of flowers below a bold yellow sky. Wilson thought he would snag it and sell the frame, but when he shared the painting with his friends, they objected, suggesting he start a collection. One of the friends, Jerry Riley, used a phrase that would become a bit of a motto, "That is so bad, it's good." Riley took the piece and hung it in his home. But the curating did not end there. Soon he and Wilson and a few others, inspired by the showpiece, were scoping out yard sales, thrift shops, and town dumps for
what
more.
An amazing hobby.
Oh, it's become so much more than a hobby. Luis Sacco, MOBA's current permanent acting interim executive director, and also Riley's sister, said it was when a busload of people arrived at Riley's home to see the collection that they realized they had to do more.
They just showed up unannounced on a bus?
I don't know exactly how that worked
out.
But a busload of people went to his home. So they opened a gallery in the Somerville Theater, a space generously donated by the theater. The collection was placed near the restrooms, the museum claiming that the constant flushing toilets helped maintain a consistent humidity level.
Sure, we need to protect the art for future generations.
Right. They also have held space at Dedham Community Theater, Brookline Access Television, the New England Wildlife Center, and more. Their space is limited, though, and MoBA's curator-in-chief, Michael Frank, is selective.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what is the criteria? Because most of the art in the world, well, sucks. Let's, you know, let's be honest. I mean, out of the huge volume of art, only a little bit of it is really good. The rest of it's just, you know, where do you draw the line? This is not bad enough, or this is bad, but still kind of good. I mean, what is the criteria?
It's part of what the museum and its curators examine. To be included in MoBA's collection, works must be original and have serious intent, but they must also have significant flaws without being boring. And curators are, quote, not interested in displaying deliberate kitsch. They accept less than 25% of what is offered to them by others, choosing instead to acquire most of the pieces themselves.
Serious intent. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. You can weed a lot of crap out that way.
Absolutely. The art then goes through a process to see if an artist can be determined and if a source material might be uncovered. A great example of this is on display during the museum's Doppelhangers exhibit. It is a depiction of American actress Marilyn Monroe. And what initially appears to be pig's feet sticking out from under her dress are actually her own feet attached to unseen knees bent as she's jumping up.
But it looks like pig feet.
Yeah. Frank says that this painting is clearly based on an image he found online by a French photographer, Philippe Haussmann, who in the 1950s did a series of people jumping in midair. So this painting was a artist's representation of that photo.
I see. Haven't mastered painting knees yet, though.
Knees are hard. Each painting or sculpture at MoBA is accompanied by a brief description of the medium, the size, the name of the artist if known, as well as how the piece was acquired. There's also an analysis of the work's possible intention or symbolism. The founders reject the idea that they are making fun of art or being snobby in any way. They protest that they celebrate any artist's right to fail gloriously.
Hear, hear.
They also think that it's important to question how one decides what is and is not bad art.
I don't understand art, but I know what I hate.
That's fair enough. Part of me believes that art is anything that can, what's that word?
Evoke.
Evoke an emotion.
I agree, 100%.
And sometimes those emotions aren't good. Do you remember that book that I read, like, I don't know, 9 years ago called The House of Sand and Fog? I fucking hated that book.
So they succeeded in creating art because they made you angry.
No, really hate that book.
Oh, okay. I really appreciate that sentiment about evoking emotion because that's what Dali said.
Yeah.
The paintings, his sculptures,
were not the art.
No, the art was the reaction that people had to seeing it.
Right. And that's so often with performance art,
yes.
what that's about, yeah. And how that woman, I cannot remember the artist's name right now, but she did that piece, the performance piece, where she stood in a room alone with a bunch of implements around her and allowed people to do whatever to her.
Yeah, that was a horrifying response.
Yeah. And the reaction of those around her absolutely was the art.
One of the objects was a gun, a pistol. And the more people that went through, the more extreme their reactions were to the point where somebody picked up the pistol, not knowing if it was loaded or not, pointed it at her head and pulled the trigger.
Ah, yes. Serbian artist Marijana Abramovic. She had 72 objects set out on the table that people could use. And it ranged from a feather or a rose to a knife, barbed wire, etc. And how people behaved in that environment was wild. And absolutely something that should be examined. Oh, that got dark. Back to bad art. The museum has had traveling exhibits. In 2001, there was an exhibition called Buck Naked, Nothing But Nudes, which featured all of MoBA's nudes hung in a local spa. They had an exhibit called Bright Colors, Dark Emotions. Also, Know What You Like / Paint How You Feel. And that's been held at the Academic Gallery in Montserrat College of Art. That's in Beverly. In an exhibit titled Awash in Bad Art, 18 pieces of art were covered in shrink wrap for the world's first drive-through museum and car wash. Marie Jackson, who was previously the director of aesthetic interpretation, noted, "We didn't put any watercolors in that exhibit."
That's smart.
Much like the nearby Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, MoBA has seen heartbreaking theft. In 1996, the painting Eileen by R. Angelo Lee vanished from MoBA. Eileen was acquired from the trash by Wilson and featured a rip in the canvas where someone had slashed it with a knife even before the museum acquired it. The museum insisted that this added an additional element of drama to an already powerful work. The museum offered a reward of $6.50 for the return of Eileen, and although MoBA donors later increased that reward to $36.73, it still remained missing for 10 years.
Oh my God.
Until in 2006, MoBA was contacted by the purported thief demanding a $5,000 ransom. No ransom was paid, but it was returned anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, could try, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Whatever.
MoBA's permanent collection has over 800 pieces, and that's stored in a secure warehouse near Boston. It also features works in rotating collections, as we've talked about. It's usually between 40 and 50 at a time. The museum unfortunately lost its physical gallery space in the basement of Somerville Theater during the pandemic, when the theater owners sought to renovate the bathroom basement area that it occupied. So it's now located at 1250 Massachusetts Avenue in the Dorchester Brewing Company.
Perfect. Let's get hammered and look at bad art.
I can't wait to get back to Massachusetts. Admission is always free, and you should absolutely go and check it out. Some of the pieces, I'm going to share a few on social media.
Okay, awesome.
And I can't wait.
I love it.
I got my information from Harvard Magazine, the Museum of Bad Art, Wikipedia, and Boston Magazine. I'm so grateful for people like this.
That rescue bad art from dumpsters?
That just curate things that they find amazing and make something that is in itself art. Like this museum is in itself a
piece of performance.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like your friend who collects abandoned grocery lists from shopping carts.
A moment for John Emack.
Well done, John. You should open a museum.
Oh my gosh, I would love that. I could help. Dear John Emack, please do this. I can help. As we mentioned, we are shortly heading to Thailand, and we are working our asses off to make sure that you have the quality content that you deserve. But also, we just don't want to have to do it for a little while we're in Thailand, because I don't know what the Wi-Fi is like.
I hear it's lovely, though.
The Wi-Fi?
Yeah, the Thai Wi-Fi. But we'll stay in touch and we'll share our travels with you as we go. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
Fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you. And its fate is in your hands. The Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. On Facebook at Facebook.com/Box of Oddities Podcast. On Twitter at Box of Oddities. And Instagram at Box of Oddities Podcast. Copyright 2023. All rights reserved.
These are the best gummy bears in the world. Okay, I'm so sorry. They're just so good. Flavor, texture.
I will never stand between you and your gummies.
So good. Okay.